it is. What's it got to do? What on earth is it doing at the close of a case?
Your point is that it's confusing the jury.
You got it.
Yeah.
It's not only confusing the jury, but it actually delegates to the jury its exclusively judicial function. The jury should never be acting as a court of review on a decision that the court makes as a matter of law. Period.
And Mr. Gentile, yeah. I mean, you've done something that I frightfully remember from junior high school when English teachers start carving up sentence context. So the question is, if we read this grammatically, is there a problem? Especially in light of other instructions.
Yes.
That are also submitted in this overall package. I have to ask that question.
I expected you to ask that, and I'm ready to answer it. Okay, but I can't do it in two words.
Mr. Gentile, just for maybe Ms. Lambros's benefit, we all have that in front of us. I don't want her arms to get tired holding that.
And besides that, she's got to list the next one now.
Oh, okay.
Because that's where I'm going.
Okay.
Okay. In order to understand this clearly, and boy, it took me a while to understand it clearly. All right, I'll be candid. It was visceral to begin with, but now it's pretty clear. What's called into question here, the only reason that there's anything wrong with that instruction, really, in the context of this case, is because the ultimate issues that the jury has to decide are identical with the conditional facts that make the evidence relevant. If this were a case in which a plaintiff's lawyer or even a prosecutor was seeking to admit into evidence under 510353E, co-conspirator evidence, okay, but there was no civil count claim or there was no count for conspiracy, we wouldn't have this problem because the jury at the end of that case would not have to consider the same elements beyond a reasonable doubt. But when you have, and by the way, this does not only apply to conspiracy cases. This is going to apply to any of the exceptions of 51035-3 C, D, and E, because all of them become party admissions because either they were adopted or authorized or it was an agent making it. And so in those instances, where the case is about that, where that is the theory of liability, be it civil or criminal, you're going to run into the same problem that this case presented, and that, especially in a criminal case, the slight evidence standard becomes unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Okay, in a civil case, it's probably a due process violation. Now, let's talk about that.
You pointed out, Justice Kennedy, that 46060-1. This is McDowell. You have decided McDowell. You don't have to change McDowell at all. There's nothing about McDowell that's wrong.
If our state wants to say that slight evidence is the admissibility standard, it can do so. You don't have to adopt preponderance of the evidence. You don't have to adopt Ojala. Okay, the same thing goes right down here in 47010. 47070-1. Same thing. It's still McDowell. There's not a problem. But if you notice, this statute never talks about a standard of evidence. What it talks about is evidence sufficient to support a finding of the fulfillment of the condition. And that changes depending upon what the case is and what stage of the proceedings you're at. And when you get down to this part, which is where Judge Adair was at the time of the jury instructions. In other words, you get down to 470702. It says if under all the evidence upon the issue, the jury might reasonably find that the fulfillment of the condition is not established, the judge shall instruct the jury to consider the issue and disregard the evidence unless they find the condition was fulfilled. In a civil case or in a criminal case where all you're doing is employing 510353E as a vehicle for the introduction of evidence, and where in those cases there is not the same exact issue to be decided by the jury at the end of the day, in terms of the criminal or civil liability, there's no problem with that. But when you get into this situation, at that stage, at the paragraph 2 stage of 47070, you can't tell the jury that the condition can be fulfilled by anything other than proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Was this particular jury instruction objected to?
It was absolutely objected to on two grounds, and I'll tell you where to find that in the record.
If you're looking for it.
You will find it in the record at, I don't know the volume, but it's page 4211 and 4212. And it actually goes to 4213. It's probably 23, 24, something like that. But that's where you're going to find it. So this is preserved. This is for you to decide. You don't have to deal with plain error here.
I might be conflating it because there was something else that there was a concern, but there was no formal objection that was noted by your client on one of the instructions. Talks in terms of the party was thinking about it, but nothing was put on the record as to the specific objection that was going to be raised.
Not this one. This one is nailed down, okay? It's not plain error. You have to address it. So the question becomes, I think we're good, Meg. The question becomes, what to do about it, okay? That's 7 minutes. I'm going to take one more.
We're going to do it, Todd, so we'll give you 3 additional minutes, and then likewise, we'll give the state 3 additional minutes.
Okay, thank you. This is structural error. There's no two ways about it, because this goes right to the heart of the question of beyond a reasonable doubt. The other jury instructions do not cure it. None of the other instructions are, first of all, although there is a narrative that you and I would understand as the elements of conspiracy, there is no jury instruction that designates them as elements. Now, what are the elements? The elements are the existence of a conspiracy, its membership, and its objective. Okay? With respect to the existence and membership, that instruction number 40 relieved the beyond the reasonable doubt standard. It left the objective. And you know what? If you take a look at what the jury did here, they understood it that way. Here's why. This, in Bolden, this court took a step forward. We're finally getting to the point where we're going to clarify conspiracy law. Yeah, it's taken a while, but we're ready, okay? In Bolden, you said that if someone is found guilty of a conspiracy, and if there's a general intent offense that was committed, it was a probable and natural consequence of the objective of the conspiracy, even if it was not itself the objective of the conspiracy, then the defendant can be held vicariously liable for that general intent offense. In this case, the state's theory from day one, and they're not going to get up here and deny it, is that Mr. Hidalgo, if he was liable at all, he was liable vicariously. And in these instructions, in instruction 18 and instruction 22, the jury is told a conspirator is legally responsible for the general intent crime that follows as one of the probable and natural consequences, yada, yada, yada. And then in 22, it identifies battery resulting in substantial bodily harm, battery with a deadly weapon, and general intent crimes. Second degree murder can be a general intent crime. And so what they did here, what they had to have done here, is they found Mr. Hidalgo guilty in the verdict form, which is the third tab, of the conspiracy, and then followed it through to a general intent offense. If that instruction number 40, was not given in this case, and if this case did not have a conspiracy as the charge, we wouldn't have a problem here. But because it was, there's no way to get around it. And Sullivan versus Louisiana is controlling here. I'll reserve the rest of my time, if I may.
Yes.
May it please please the court. My name is Mark DiGiacomo. I am a deputy district attorney, and I'm here representing the state of Nevada in this particular appeal. I want to start with something Justice Douglas kind of started with, was to go back to the record as it relates to this particular instruction, because the morphosis of this argument made by Mr. Gentile here today isn't something that really the district court addressed pre-trial. She did address it on the motion for new trial. So if you go to the transcripts, and unfortunately I was in the co-defendants, this is volume 10, it's day 12 of trial, but it's right, it's 4211 to 4212. This starts off with, what about this instruction? The co-defendant says, we object. Mr. Gentile says something to the effect of, well, this could be confusing, let me think about it for a moment. And then he says something to the effect of, well, not having it kind of disfavors the defendant, but for the record, I'll object to it. But there's no discussion about, you know, should you be making a preliminary question of admissibility or not. There was no litigation whatsoever until the motion for new trial comes along.
There was, in the record, and then as you pointed out, and going back to my notes, there was a larger contextual issue as to co-conspirator, I guess, that this was bundled within when that objection was made, because it also goes further in the record as of through 4219.
There is a large discussion subsequent, not related to this particular instruction, but there is a very large discussion in this case. And Mr. Gentile's right, I'm not going to deny it. This is a vicarious liability case. I mean, he issued the hit. Whether the hit was to kill, the hit was to really harm him really badly, or just to beat him up a little bit. And that was the question in the case, is if he's guilty, what level of crime is he guilty of? And there are 10 separate instructions that talk about reasonable doubt, the defendants need to be proven as part of the conspiracy, and that the conspiracy itself, the nature of the conspiracy, had to be proven beyond reasonable doubt. There's 10 separate times that the reasonable doubt language appears in the instruction. The argument is that instruction is it should never be given to a jury. Well, the first question is okay, well, it's the same instruction that we've given in every conspiracy case that we've ever had in the last, 13 years that I've been here. The argument was, well, this federal law says it shouldn't be given. Well, that's because federal law 104A, Nevada Rule Federal Evidence, says judge makes a determination and there is no corollary 47070 in federal rules. There's none. It used to be there in the early 1970s, and in the mid-70s, they changed it and decided that they're no longer going to submit questions of admissibility to the jury, or relevance, conditional relevance to a jury. Nevada never adopted that. So the court was required, because their entire argument was there was no independent evidence here of a conspiracy. The court was required to instruct the jury in some manner how it is to utilize this conditionally relevant evidence, because some of the most powerful evidence in this case are the co-conspirator statements. After listening to those two wires, there is no question that Mr. H is involved in the conspiracy to kill Mr. Hadlin or to harm him really badly, as the jury ultimately determined. There isn't any question at that point if those recordings are admissible. And their entire argument in this case was there isn't independent evidence of it. You can't believe Annabelle Espinola. You have to look at the, and there's no independent evidence to establish it. And one of the most powerful pieces are the two recordings that happened on May 23rd and May 24th. After our response to the appeal saying, hey, 47070 says you gotta do this, then they write a reply brief in which they start listing out a number of cases that talk about prejudice. Except for when you go and read the cases, none of them talk about this instruction being prejudicial. Absolutely none of them. Back in the 80s and 90s, the cases that they cited, there was a jury instruction in federal court that we've never used in Nevada. It has something to do with the laws that relates to federal law and conspiracy. And that instruction said, when you have a conspiracy that is established beyond a reasonable doubt, if there is slight evidence that a defendant is a member of the conspiracy, he can be convicted. Or if there is a slight connection to the defendant to the conspiracy, he can be convicted. And that's when the court said, well, you can't give that instruction because that does seem to suggest that the beyond a reasonable doubt standard doesn't apply to his conviction for the conspiracy. This is in, number 40 is in a section of the instructions that are nowhere near the elements of the offense of this particular case. It is in a section of the instructions that deals with how the jury is supposed to bifurcate through the evidence, and if you read the language of it, it in no way implies that the burden of the state is less than beyond a reasonable doubt. And if you have any question of that, go look at the arguments of all the counsel in this case to the jury. Every one of us said the same thing to this jury, which is, you have to find Mr. H guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. You have to find him a member of this conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt. And the reason you can use the wire recordings to do that is because there's independent evidence of the conspiracy and went through that entire thing. There is absolutely no authority whatsoever that, one, that instruction is prejudicial. No, not in federal court, not in state court, not anywhere, that that's a prejudicial instruction. And in fact, most of the cases cited by the defense that discuss Rule 104A, it's the defense attorney asking to have a similar instruction. Obviously, they have different standards in federal, but they're asking for the jury to make this determination. And the court says, no, the court doesn't have to because the court decides preliminary questions of admissibility. It has never been found that somehow this is going to confuse a jury. In fact, Judge Adair made that specific ruling when she counted out the 10 different places in the jury instructions where the jury is told, beyond a reasonable doubt, you must find Mr. Hidalgo, both a member of the conspiracy and what the conspiracy was beyond a reasonable doubt.
I don't want to interrupt you on this, Trent. I had a couple questions on some other issues here.
I was just about to turn to some of the other issues that were raised in the defense brief, so if you want to go ahead.
Yeah, my questions would be, first, the plea deal with Ms. Espinola, why that wasn't disclosed, why it wasn't recorded or memorialized in some way, so the defense would be in a position to inquire and bias on that with her testimony. Secondly, Mr. Carroll's statements. He was unavailable to testify, so there was a confrontation issue that's been raised in this appeal. Why was he unavailable, and why does the issue of, I think, context is something the state has argued. You can get the recording with him involved, even though he didn't testify out of context, without a violation of Mr. Hidalgo's rights of confrontation. So if you'd address those issues.
In fact, I can address both of those issues as it relates to Ms. Espinola, and I think I was in front of this panel just 2 months ago addressing the exact same issue. In this particular case, first, to say it wasn't documented is incorrect. Immediately upon the completion of her proffer, Detective Wildman wrote an arrest report which laid out everything Annabelle Espinola said happened during the crime itself, and was part of the original arrest report signed by a judge that arrested Mr. Hidalgo. So her story at the proffer was documented. Was the actual proffer itself documented? That answer is no, but they seem to suggest it's because I wouldn't allow it to be recorded, and that's just simply not the case. The court, I know at least some of this court has been down in criminal courts, and you've certainly seen all the criminal appeals that come up here. Defendants and the state are in an adversarial position. Mr. Orem sought to see if he could resolve this case. The state was like, well, we want to know what she has to say, and Mr. Orem was like, I'll let her talk to you, but I want off the record, because what happens if we can't reach a deal? I don't want you to have a recording of Ms. Espinola should she have to testify that you can go through on the stand. And it was Mr. Orem's request that proffer not be recorded. Now, I'm the state of Nevada. I am prosecuting Annabelle Espinola. Am I supposed to say to myself, no, I'm not willing to accept to hear what Ms. Espinola says, and therefore, I can't resolve her case, she has to go to trial? I mean, is that the standard that we're going to set here for criminal defendants? We get proffers in cases where there isn't any hope for future testimony either. There are sometimes defendants want to just, they want to tell us a story and see what we think as to a possible negotiation. But what she said was documented. And more importantly, as it concerns to prejudice here, Mr. Orem, Ms. Espinola waived her attorney-client privilege. Mr. Orem testified. He met Ms. Espinola a day or two after she went to jail in 2005, and this trial was in 2009, I believe. And he met with her some 80 to 90 times, and her story was always the same, both prior to the offer, proffer, and after the proffer. This is what she said happened, and it was always what she said happened, and nothing about the offer of the state changed that. And, you know, I've had many cases with Mr. Orme where at night I'd go to sleep cursing him, and in the morning I'd get up cursing him. But the fact of the matter is that I don't think there's anybody, and I know this court knows Mr. Orme, is going to think he's going to come in here and perjure himself for a client of his. That doesn't make any sense to me. He certainly wasn't on my side of the case, certainly prior to the proffer, and he's certainly not on my side afterwards. There's some mention in the brief that Ms. Espadola didn't get probation. She didn't. She went to prison. And she's currently serving a prison sentence now at the High Desert Women's. As it relates to D'Angelo Carroll, D'Angelo Carroll was still set for trial, and he was the last remaining defendant. We tried to try Mr. Carroll first. We couldn't. His case, and I don't know that this is in the record, but certainly his case, there's replete references to the efforts to negotiate Mr. Carroll's case, and he just wasn't willing, or we weren't willing to meet what he wanted to meet. So ultimately, he's unavailable. And then the question becomes, what happens when you're unavailable? And in this court, and I know it's in our briefs, we don't have to go through, relied on a federal court case years ago called Tenenbaum, in which a confidential informant had a conversation with the defendant, and ultimately that confidential informant becomes unavailable. Well, what do you do? Well, it's no different than a detective who takes a statement from the defendant, and the detective, you know, God forbid he dies, or he's unavailable, or some other reason. Mr. Carroll's statements are not admitted for the truth of the matter asserted. They're only admitted to give context to the responses from the individuals, in this case, both Annabelle Espindola and Louis Hidalgo III. Those two individuals were clearly established as co-conspirators, and their statements were clearly in furtherance of the conspiracy, and they're admissible for such. And this kind of ties into the argument for a motion for new trial that the defense made, because they say that the jury heard D'Angelo Carroll say, he ordered me to do this and I did it, as opposed to you ordered me to do this and I did it. And to me, it's irrelevant, both legally and factually, to be honest.
So the issue with Mr. Carroll is the criminal charges were still pending against him, so there's a Fifth Amendment issue on him testifying.
Correct.
That's why he's unavailable.
He was completely unavailable at that point. And the issue as it relates to the motion for new trial is the defense tried to assert that somehow they could get into the minds of the juror, and the court's well aware you can't do that. But if you read actually 42:11-12, and you keep reading through the jury instructions, all the way up to 42:19, there's a very, very long discussion as to what the jury could do in Mr. Carroll's statements. Our position was that you couldn't consider him for the truth of the matter asserted at all. That he was just making statements, and then what Annabelle and Little Lou responded were relevant to the determination as to Mr. Afey's guilt. And it was Mr. Gentile who said, no, there's context. When two people have a conversation, when you listen to the conversation, you can figure out what each person already knows. They have a common mutual ground between them. And so if one person doesn't correct the other person, it's because they understood certain facts. And I should be able to argue circumstantially to the jury that, you know, Annabelle Espindola is more involved in this crime than she's admitting. And you can tell that from the nature of the conversation between D'Angelo Carroll and Annabelle Espindola. Now, I don't know if that's legally correct or not correct. I said I object to that, but the judge allowed them to do it. And so their argument was when D'Angelo Carroll said, you told me to do that, that was saying Annabelle issued the order, and therefore Annabelle must be guilty. Well, and the jury, if that's in fact true, and now after they said it, I listened to that recording a few hundred more times, and maybe he says it, he, instead of you. But ultimately, it's irrelevant other than in assessing Annabelle Espindola. If D'Angelo Carroll said to Annabelle Phillip, he told me to do this, and she goes on with the conversation, then that's exactly what Mr. Gentile was arguing, which is they have a common understanding between them, and it goes directly to Annabelle Espindola's credibility when she says, I didn't issue the order, Mr. H issued the order. I wasn't there for the order. The only thing I said was go to Plan B, which is actually corroborated by those recordings.
Okay, on this issue too, Mr. Gentile, I'd like him to address it when he comes back, is there was, your position is there was corroboration of the accomplice testimony by showing the $5,000 payment by Mr. Hidalgo Jr. to Mr. Carroll, then, correct?
Well, I mean, that alone has got to be sufficient, right? He paid the money, so that alone has got to tend to connect you to the crime. But there are other things independent of that, and I was going to address that because they seem to suggest to this court that this court could consider Ronte's own an accomplice. The law on accomplice is very clear in the state of Nevada. Hagemeyer, Rowland, all of those cases all say the same thing. There are some that are accomplices as a matter of law, and maybe it's up to dispute, but the jury instructed Annabella Spindola is an accomplice as a matter of law. She had to be corroborated. You couldn't rely just on her. But Hagemeyer Rowland says, unless the witness's testimony specifically makes them liable for the crime, it's a jury question. The jury gets to decide whether or not Bronte Zone is an accomplice or not an accomplice. So a reviewing court can't make the assumption that somehow he was an accomplice. His testimony was, I didn't want anything to do with this, I had nothing to do with this, and I had no desire, nor did I receive any benefit from this. I was the merely present person. And there is zero evidence to the contrary in this entire case, no matter which co-defendant you're talking about. There is simply no evidence that Ronte Zone did anything further to the conspiracy, and it's why he was never charged with the crime. It's why he showed up at a preliminary hearing and testified. It's because he has absolutely no connection to this crime. And so when he testifies to the co-conspirator statements, when D'Angelo Carroll said, well, Little Lou told me Mr. H wanted somebody hurt or killed, done, whatever the word is that he used, his testimony to this fact, his testimony as to going to the Palomino, his testimony to what happened, the testimony that there's three people in the car, Jason Taiupu said he was willing to do it. Jason Taiupu admits that. All of those factors that Bronte's own testified to as related to Mr. H, including that the day after the crime when he's down at Simone's Auto Plaza, in the truck owned by Mr. H, that he sees D'Angelo Carroll and Mr. H have a conversation, and after that conversation, D'Angelo Carroll comes over and finds them in the bathroom and tells them, hey, you guys could have gotten paid by basically the old man. He'd have paid you had you guys been involved, but you guys weren't involved, so you guys didn't get paid. All of that evidence tends to connect Mr. H to the crime. There's some suggestion in this case that we didn't have probable cause to arrest Mr. H until Annabelle ruled. Well, the opposite is true. We had the corroboration in this case since May 24th of 2005. What we didn't have was the accomplice. D'Angelo Carroll refused to negotiate, and it wasn't until Annabelle Espindola negotiated that we actually had the accomplice in this case. And from there, it felt like beyond reasonable doubt could be made in front of a jury. Not probable cause. Certainly, we could have arrested Mr. H. The question is were we going to go to trial without the underlying story of what happened inside the Palomino? Without Annabelle, you don't really have that understanding of the entire complex of how this crime began and where it ultimately ended. The phone records themselves, every time Annabelle goes to call D'Angelo, right before that there's a phone call from Mr. H to Annabelle. So when Mr. H lies to the police when they get to the Palomino the next day after the murder, and he says, I don't know how to get a hold of D'Angelo, though his phone number is right behind his head at his desk that he sits up in his office, the cops leave. First phone call to Annabelle, next phone call goes directly to D'Angelo Carroll from there. And so when you put it all together, there was certainly overwhelming corroboration of Annabelle Espindola's, whether or not you consider Mr. Zone an accomplice or not, but I think as a matter of law, you can't do so. Thank you.
It has always been my understanding that you're supposed to stick to the record when you argue an appeal. And you've just heard about 10 minutes of stuff that does not exist in this record at all. Mm-hmm. Let me point out a couple just to let you know. Mr. DiGiacomo's forgotten the case. He's forgotten the facts of the case. Where did he even start? Let me start with something simple. He keeps arguing the admissibility issue. That was never in question. You know, in order to make a record to preserve your objection to the admission of hearsay evidence, you not only have to object to it, but at the close of the state's case, you're supposed to make a motion to strike. Because if you don't do that, you really haven't preserved the appellate issue. I know that, and I knew it then. And guess what I didn't do at the trial? I didn't make a motion to strike, which means that I conceded the issue with respect to the admissibility. I'm not here arguing admissibility. I'm arguing a jury instruction that really wasn't necessary because admissibility was no longer an issue. And that was deliberate. Now, if you don't want me to do that anymore, then write an opinion that says that I'm supposed to, even if I don't, even if I believe that it, that McDowell is not only the appropriate law, but that its conditions have been met. So none of that is before you. We're here on an instruction. The $5,000 payment. The $5,000 payment, if you, there's an Exhibit 241. Jerry DePalma, you know, he talked about Wiley Chris Oram, why. Chris Oram, after he argued the case against John Aristotle a couple weeks ago, I went and reread the record. Chris Oram never said on the record that it was his idea that Annabelle not be recorded. And Acuna and Leslie talk about accomplice witnesses. They don't talk about all witnesses. They don't talk about all state's witnesses. They don't talk about all witnesses that are cooperative witnesses. They talk about accomplice witnesses. Accomplice witnesses, as a matter of legislative policy, are different. Accomplice testimony is admissible without corroboration. If a jury does have the issue, as it did here about Annabelle as well, they can read. This is what's really strange about the accomplice testimony law. If the jury finds that it's an accomplice witness, the jury has to seek corroboration. Take the same witness and the jury decides not to find that witness being an accomplice, that witness doesn't need to be corroborated. Now, I'm not sure about the symmetry of that, but it doesn't make any sense to me. Okay? But Leslie and Acuna say that accomplices are different, and that when you're going to do a deal with an accomplice, you have to make the information available. Every witness in this case, Mr. Zone, and that's in the record, Mr. D'Angelo Carroll, that's in the record, Annabelle Espindola, when she was first interviewed, and it's in the record, all three of them were videotaped during those interviews. Videotaped, not just recorded, videotaped. But when it came time to interview Annabelle when she was going to make a deal after 32 months in waiting for this case to start, and right after this court basically threw out the initial indictment and the death penalty with it, and while the petition for rehearing was being considered, she came back knowing that she might be facing the death penalty again. And at that point in time, she made a deal. And that deal contemplated the possibility of probation. And that's in the record. And at that point in time, if Acuna and Leslie mean anything, and if confrontation means anything, then just like they videotaped her the first time, they should have at least done a recording of her the second time. So if you're going to allow them to get out of the intent of Leslie and Acuna by merely not recording, well, then Leslie and Acuna are hollow. And this court wasted its time in deciding them. They're a platitude and nothing more. There's never been any question with respect to the McDowell standard. I never moved to strike. And, you know, you talk about Oram's credibility. Take a look at the testimony of Annabelle. And take a look at the fact that Jerome DePalma, a member of this bar, just like Mr. Oram, and Don Bibble, I think a respected homicide detective when he was with Metro, and then later on went on to become the investigator for the federal defender and went into private investigation and worked for me at the time. They testified in this case as well. And DePalma put 6 pages of his notes in. And along with his testimony, he said, when I did that interview, Annabelle did all the talking. She's the one who said all of the things that she's now saying Hidalgo said. And what did Annabelle say to that? I never talked to DePalma or Bibble. So if we're going to get into credibility contest, that's why Justice Gibbons, Acuna, and Leslie should require that an accomplice witness who's being debriefed in order to make a deal, it's a come-line bet at that point. She doesn't have a deal yet. that that ought to be recorded, and you shouldn't be able to. And what happened here? They didn't record it. They had notes, and the court lost the notes. So you wouldn't even have those notes in front of you. The notes were made part of the record. I moved to have them. The court made them a part of the record. She said that she wanted them a court's exhibit. We don't even have those. So in the big picture here, the need to record the accomplice is great. Okay. One last, and the confrontation issue, I only have 13 seconds left. Let me get to why you need to reverse and what you ought to do. And please, I beg you, I'm going to make a suggestion. Don't take this as arrogance, okay? But what we need to do here is we need to reverse this case. Can I continue?
Go ahead.
Okay. We need to reverse this case and remand it. All right, either for a new trial or, candidly, for a hearing. Let Mr. Owen get on the stand. Let me ask him under oath if it was his idea, because you don't have anything in front of you to say that. And to save the constitutionality of 47070, construe it in a way that is constitutional. And in order to do that, you have to recognize that McDowell was limited to the question of admissibility. The slight evidence standard is limited to the question of admissibility. You also have to just make it clear, McDowell did, that it's the judge's decision, it's nobody else's, and the statute does that too. You have to recognize that what it takes to fulfill a condition in accordance with this statute changes as the trial goes along. Okay? And where the ultimate issues that the jury has to decide are the same as the issues for conditional relevance, which only applies in a few cases, but all conspiracy cases. Where that's the case, then let the jury decide it, but what is required to fulfill the condition at that stage is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. If you do that, you're good.
Mr. Gentile, since you bring it up, I guess the issue is for me, since it seems like that issue of reasonable doubt and proof beyond seem to have been argued in closing as these instructions, or I might be mistaken. Also, this issue has a structural error. If we look at Sullivan versus Louisiana, U.S. Case, and Cortinas versus State, in terms of equating reasonable doubt, misquoting it, so to speak, is the only time in jury instructions has been deemed as structural error.
All right. Why don't we get there in this case? Because a case of this nature has never been presented to any court on this issue. Okay, and that's the reason. You know, what's worse, a misdescription or a contrary statement? Don't they amount to the same thing? Collins, when this court decided Collins, it said that you got to reverse them because you're unable to say that the instruction did not create an advantage to the state or a prejudice to the defendant. And you know what? You're not able to say that. And so if you follow Collins, the case has to be reversed. But as I said, in addition, the evidence here with respect to Louis Hidalgo Jr. was slight at best.
How did you, if I may just say, what was your theory of why Mr. Hidalgo Jr. paid $5,000 to Mr. Carroll?
Actually, it's borne out in the Palma's notes, which is the reason, and I can supplement this record with 241, exhibit 241. From day one, when Annabelle met with the Palma, she told the Palma that Louis paid the $5,000 because he took what D'Angelo Carroll said about, you don't want to fuck with my homie, as a threat, because he knew that that the homie, who turned out to be, maybe it turned out to be the guy who got convicted, I'm not sure, but I think so. The homie was a member of the Crips or the Bloods or some gang, and Louis Hidalgo had prior experience as a peace officer in San Jose, and in the Palma's notes, Annabelle said that he paid the $5,000 because he was afraid. He took it as a threat to his family.
And so it was extortion or something.
Yes, basically to get him to protect his family. Okay. And by the way, the instructions themselves, at least from day one, our argument was at worst, Louis Hidalgo was an accessory after the fact by paying that $5,000 so that this guy would get away.
So, nothing else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank counsel on both sides for the argument 6.8, attempting to clarify what's in the record. And giving us something to think about. With that, we'll stand in a short recess before we take our remaining matters. Case submitted.